ghost pepper has a reputation. So does a ghost pepper wing that doesn't send you into tears make any sense? Does to us. That's why Popeye's ghost pepper wings are the perfect balance of flavor and fire. Popeye starts with intensely craveable flavor, adds the right amount of kick to keep things interesting, not inferno-ing, and then offers them at only $5 for 6 pieces. Because in New Orleans, we like to taste our food, not cry over it. Call us crazy.
Love that chicken from Popeye's.
Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Additional terms apply.
Thanks for switching lanes to Raising Cane's.
One box combo, please.
That's 4 juicy chicken fingers. We'll start cooking. Garlicky butter Texas toast tastes as good as it's looking. Fresh coleslaw and crispy fries you won't be skipping. And our secret cane sauce you'll want to keep dipping. Plus, our lemonade or iced tea made fresh today by me. Yo, 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 here's your chicken to go.
Wow, that was fast.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ed Robinson, and welcome to another exciting edition of The Robinson Show. On the program, I have Chris Bornay. Chris is a journalist, author, and filmmaker from Columbus, Ohio. He is the director and producer of the documentary Lady Wrestler. The documentary focuses on the journey of African-American female professional wrestlers during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. On the program, we discuss his hometown of Columbus, Ohio, introduction to professional wrestling, the Lady Wrestler documentary, mental health, and much more. Chris is coming up after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Robinson Show.
Thanks for switching lanes to Raising Cane's.
One box combo, please.
That's 4 juicy chicken fingers you won't be skipping, and our secret cane sauce you want to keep dipping.
Wow, that was fast.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love.
Thanks for switching lanes to Raising Cane's.
One box combo, please.
That's 4 juicy chicken fingers. We'll start cooking. Garlicky butter Texas toast tastes as good as it's looking. Fresh coleslaw and crispy fries you won't be skipping. And our secret cane sauce you want to keep dipping. Plus, our lemonade or iced tea made fresh today by me. Yo, 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 here's your chicken to go.
Wow, that was fast.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love.
Thanks for switching lanes to Raising Cane's.
One box combo, please.
That's 4 juicy chicken fingers. We'll start cooking. Garlicky butter Texas toast tastes as good as it's looking. Fresh coleslaw and crispy fries you won't be skipping. And our secret cane sauce you want to keep dipping. Plus, our lemonade or iced tea made fresh today by me. Yo, 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 here's your chicken to go.
Wow, that was fast.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love.
Thanks for switching lanes to Raising Cane's.
One box combo, please.
That's 4 juicy chicken fingers. We'll start cooking. Garlicky butter Texas toast tastes as good as it's looking. Fresh coleslaw and crispy fries you won't be skipping. And our secret cane sauce you want to keep dipping. Plus, our lemonade or iced tea made fresh today by me. Yo, 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 here's your chicken to go.
Wow, that was fast.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love.
The ghost pepper has a reputation. So does a ghost pepper wing that doesn't send you into tears make any sense? Does to us. That's why Popeye's ghost pepper wings are the perfect balance of flavor and fire. Popeye starts with intensely craveable flavor, adds the right amount of kick to keep things interesting, not inferno-ing, and then offers them at only $5 for 6 pieces. Because in New Orleans, we like to taste our food, not cry over it. Call us crazy.
Love that chicken from Popeye's.
Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Additional terms apply.
Babs and Ethel soon distinguished themselves from the pack. In 1953, Babs wrestled World Wrestling Champion Mildred Burke before a crowd of nearly 9,000 fans in Kansas City in what was billed as the first interracial championship.
The idea of putting a black woman in the wrestling ring, a sexy, good-looking athlete who moved well, and pitting her against a white woman or another black woman, he just thought that was a way to really attract the crowds and really attract the buzz, and it was, and it worked.
When executing often dangerous wrestling holds, Babs and Ethel showed amazing skill and ability.
My person, I could hook them with my foot, or I could hook them this way, or hook them that way, you know, or go behind, is what they say, go behind and face slam them, you know. These type of things that lots of girls didn't do. I worked in the sense they say mostly like the guys.
The lady wrestlers were in such peak physical condition that they could have given their male counterparts a run for their money.
Indeed. All right, welcome back to the program, everybody. That audio is courtesy of Mousetrap Entertainment and also of Chris Bornay's official YouTube channel. And that audio that you heard was a clip from the Lady Wrestler documentary. That was Chris talking about the importance of black female professional wrestlers between the 1950s, 1960s, and the 1970s, talking about the struggles that they had to endure. And that other voice that you heard was the late Ethel Johnson just talking about being involved in professional wrestling. To talk more about Lady Wrestler and, of course, black women in professional wrestling and so much more, let's welcome him to the program. He's a journalist, author, and a filmmaker based out of Columbus, Ohio, and also he is the director of and producer of Lady Wrestler, the documentary. Let's welcome him to the program, Chris Bornay. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ed. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, brother, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us on the program. So Columbus, Ohio, you know, when people think of Columbus, Ohio, the first thing that comes to their mind is the Ohio State University. And also with Columbus, a popular rapper, I think he calls himself Bow Wow. He grew up in Columbus for a brief period of time. But what was Columbus, Ohio like for you growing up?
Yeah, you know, not just Bow Wow, but also Philip Michael Thomas from Miami Vice, Bernie Casey, you know, was a football star and a movie star. There are a lot of actual actors and singers and well-known people. Nancy Wilson, the jazz star, she grew up in Columbus, actually Central Ohio, the greater Columbus area. So when I was growing up in Columbus in the 70s and 80s, you know, it's not like it was Hollywood or anything, but I was sort of aware of people who had come before me who had made their mark in the world. But for some reason, even though I grew up, you know, in the black community, I'm African American, you know, I'd never heard about these women, even though my first couple of journalism jobs were at black newspapers. I'd never heard about these women until a friend of mine, a publicist who's also an African American man named Terry Anderson, introduced me to Ethel, and I interviewed her for the local daily newspaper, the Columbus Dispatch. So even though I knew Columbus had this history of history makers, including Jesse Owens, who went to Ohio State, I did not know about these women. So it's just kind of remarkable that their history has been kind of lost all these years until now.
There's some great history, as you educated me and the rest of the listeners on, about not just Ohio, but specifically Columbus in general. And, of course, Jesse Owens, how could I forget about him, another one that repped the Buckeye State. And I want to transition now into the next topic, which is documentary filmmaking. How were you introduced to the world of documentary filmmaking?
Well, I had always wanted to be a writer and a filmmaker when I was growing up. I always admired people who are what they call polymaths, meaning people who master more than one skill or talent, I guess. People like Quincy Jones, you know, who's not only a musician, but also published Vibe magazine and was a movie producer. He produced The Color Purple. People like Debbie Allen, who's not just a dancer and a choreographer and an actress, but has gone on to be a producer and a filmmaker. So I grew up admiring people like that and always kind of saw myself, you know, maybe arrogantly so, but kind of saw myself in that vein. So even though creative writing was always kind of my first love, because I grew up writing poetry and plays and would start writing books and never finish them. But so creative writing was my first love, but I always had my eye on kind of transitioning into filmmaking. And we have a career center in a performing arts high school here in Columbus called Fort Hays, and I took radio and television production there. So I always had my eye on one day getting into filmmaking. And when I had the privilege of interviewing Ethel Johnson, I just thought, her story is so amazing and so grand, it's bigger than just a newspaper article. So after the newspaper article was published in the Columbus Dispatch, this was actually back in March of 2006 during Women's History Month, I asked her if she would agree to be interviewed on camera for a documentary because I just thought her story just lent itself to a documentary. And fortunately, she said yes. And in my research, I came across so many other women who were her peers, like Kathleen Wembley and Ramona Isbell. Ramona's in the documentary as well. And Ethel's own sisters, Babs, Wingo, and Marva Scott. So I just found out there were dozens of these courageous Black women, many of them who were from Columbus, who had unfortunately kind of faded into obscurity. But I sort of stumbled into documentary filmmaking. I didn't necessarily want to become a documentary filmmaker per se. I just wanted to be a filmmaker.
Awesome. And again, as they say, journalism is always connected to many forms of expression and forms of different production. And it goes from, as you stated, you go to the Performing Arts High School where you're learning about radio and TV, and it kind of connects the dots from radio, TV, film, creative writing, and then getting into documentaries. So it all goes hand in hand in some form of fashion. And you mentioned about
right.
the women that you interviewed in this documentary. Before we get more into detail about those ladies that were featured and, of course, about the documentary, professional wrestling, a lot of people have different names for it. Some people say it's a circus. Some people call it the Broadway with muscles and so on and so forth. But were you a professional wrestling fan growing up? And if so, how were you introduced to it?
Yeah, I was a professional wrestling fan growing up. I was introduced to it by early cable television. So I was partly raised by my grandparents, Bob and Pearl Bornet, and they were sort of ahead of their time, sort of, because they were one of the first families, you know, that I knew of who had cable television. I'm talking about starting back in the late 70s. So I would go over their house, and I would watch professional wrestling on what was then WTBS. You know, which was a station owned by Ted Turner in Atlanta. And so I became a big fan of Roddy Piper and that whole professional wrestlers. And I actually got to interview Roddy Piper for the documentary, which was, you know, kind of a cool full circle moment. But then as I grew older, kind of when I got to high school, I didn't grow out of being a professional wrestling fan. I just sort of didn't really think of it that much because I've never been particularly athletic or ironically a huge sports fan in general. I'm the kind of person that if I go see a sporting event in person, I can enjoy it, but I'm not going to go, like, seek it out on television. And, like, some people plan their whole weekend around, you know, what's on, the sports that are playing on TV. That I've never been that guy. But so I was more interested in with the story of these women, sort of the Black history angle, more so than the wrestling angle. And it's, you know, interesting the terms you use because I look at Ethel and her era of wrestlers were, they did have that entertainment value to it, and a lot of their matches were choreographed, but they also had to know the wrestling. They had to be real athletes, in other words. They had to know all the wrestling holds, as Jeff Lean from that clip you played in the documentary goes into. These women were real athletes. They trained for hours a day, just like any other athlete. And I always compare it to dancing. You wouldn't say a ballerina who trains from the age of, you know, elementary school, if she just doesn't get up there and freestyle, oh, she's not a real dancer because she's doing choreography. There are respect for the arts disciplines in which choreographed routines are, you know, you don't say an actor can't act because they're not coming up with dialogue. They're not improvising. They're, you know, off the top of their head coming up with brilliant lines. They're given a script, but the way they act out that script shows their talent. So that's how I think of professional wrestling is a, especially in Ethel's day, was a discipline to really, really, really know the sport, and you had to have all the skills of any professional athlete. But, yes, a lot of their matches were scripted or choreographed or however you want to term it, but that doesn't take away from their athleticism and from their very authentic ability, in my opinion.
No, you're absolutely right in your opinion, and I've been saying this for decades. I mean, yeah, we know wrestling – again, it's choreographed, but there's also a lot of psychology that goes into this. I mean, from a ring perspective,
yeah.
You're playing on a role, and you're either playing along with the crowd's emotions, whether positive or negative, happy or sad, whatever it is, and then they're doing promos, and they're talking the talk, and then you have to do the athletic portion. So definitely professional wrestling is something that is it has to be taken very seriously. And before we get more into the documentary, I want to stay just with your introduction to professional wrestling. You mentioned about watching it with your grandparents when at a time when cable television was relatively new. And you mentioned about Roddy Piper being one of your favorite wrestlers. Who were some of your other favorite wrestlers growing up?
Yeah, really that whole cohort. And, I didn't really know about women's wrestling when I was a kid. I sort of knew it existed, but I didn't know any of the women who were famous for it. So that whole, like, Roddy Piper, Andre the Giant, Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, just all those wrestlers that you would see on TBS, that's who I was into at that time. The ones who were superstars. I didn't even really know about male wrestlers like Bobo Brazil. That was not, that history wasn't taught to me in any way, shape, or form. So I just sort of knew the, for lack of a better word, the famous white guys that happened to be on WTBS at the time.
Boy, people forget easily the WTBS or the Superstation, for that matter, aired a lot of a great wrestling at the time, of course, with WCW, and even before that, you can go research it for yourself. It was definitely a groundbreaking cable channel during that period of time. And let's talk now about Lady Wrestler. And you mentioned about getting in contact with Mrs. Ethel Johnson, and she agreed to be in the documentary, which actually began, as you said, with the piece that you interviewed for the newspaper that you were working for at the time. Just tell me, what was the motivation and what was the genesis of developing what would become Lady Wrestler?
Yeah, in interviewing Ethel, I was just taken away and blown away by her story. Here she was, she got into wrestling when she was a preteen. She wasn't even a teenager yet. She was like 11 or 12. And because her older sister, Babs, had actually been what the industry recognizes as the first professional black woman wrestler. So Babs Wingo, Ethel's older sister, sort of got Ethel into the business. And then Ethel became the first black female champion, or that's how the industry recognizes her in that regard. So her talking about how she would go all over the world, Canada, Japan, Australia, even in Latin America, she had a ring name, Rita Valdez. So here is this young black woman and her sisters and her peers going all over the world when a lot of women didn't even work outside the home, except for, as I note in the documentary, a lot of black women have always worked outside of the home out of financial necessity. But here she is doing this, what many people would consider to be a glamorous, unconventional thing for a woman. And she was treated like a superstar in a lot of these other countries. And then when, just like any other black person, when she would go into the Deep South, she would have to deal with Jim Crow segregation. She would have to go in the back door of restaurants. She would have to stay in segregated rooming houses. If she was just walking down the street window shopping before a match, she would have to step off the sidewalk out of deference to a white person coming toward her. So I thought her story encompasses so many elements. Like there's the feminism element of this young black woman doing unconventional things for a woman. There's the black history angle of before the civil rights movement. I'm talking in the early 50s, before Dr. King and Rosa Parks and a lot of those milestones of the civil rights movement happened. These black women were going into segregated areas and sometimes even wrestling opponents of different races. So I just thought her story had so many different grand elements to it that it just had to be more than a newspaper article. And rather than me try to, go approach Spike Lee or, I mentioned Debbie Allen, or Oprah or Tyler Perry or somebody like that, I thought, okay, well, I have an interest in filmmaking. I know how to at least turn the camera on. Let me record these women's oral history while they're still here. So it was really just as simple as that. I just thought, why not me? Ethel trusts me enough to open up and tell me her story, so why not me to make a documentary about her life and the other women that she worked with?
I tell you one thing, it's nothing like taking a risk and taking matters into your own hands, and it definitely paid off for you, and this is what came to life, Lady Wrestler, the movie. And I want to stay just with Lady Wrestler for a moment. Earlier on, you mentioned about them learning the craft in terms of being in shape and taking bumps and things of that nature. in the documentary, were there any mentions about how often they trained, or should I say, were they formally trained? Did they go to a wrestling school, or did they just have a natural knack, a natural wrestling ability? And I know, again, due to segregation, they weren't allowed to go to fitness centers and things of that nature. So two-part question. First question is, were they formally trained, and how did they stay in shape?
Yeah, they were formally trained. So you asked, did they just have a natural knack for it, and were they formally trained? So the answer to both questions is yes. Because Ethel talked about in the documentary, she says that she and her sister Babs, first of all, they started just sort of getting into shape with their older brothers. They would make makeshift weights out of like bricks and sticks and make their own little barbells. You know, they were just kids playing around. They had no idea they were going to end up being athletes. And then for some reason, they just, their family was into physical fitness, and there was a YMCA where a lot of black families were able to go, and Ethel and Babs took defensive judo, and they kind of learned tumbling techniques. They had no idea they were training for wrestling. This was just something that was like they were doing for fun and recreation and to stay in shape. And so then the person who was responsible for bringing women and really putting women's wrestling on the map is a promoter named Billy Wolf. Now, he is infamous because in a lot of ways, he was ahead of his time. He made a lot of opportunities for women and for black women in particular. He groomed and married the first women's world wrestling champion, Mildred Burke. But Billy Wolf and Mildred Burke were both white. Billy Wolf and Mildred were from Missouri, and for some reason they settled in Columbus. I think from what I heard is that because Columbus is almost squarely in the center of the country, and you can get to the majority of the country within a day's drive. So when Billy Wolf was promoting wrestling matches, this was before air travel was really common, because he started in the 1930s promoting matches. So the wrestlers would often have to drive to their matches, so they were able to get there in a relatively short amount of time driving from Columbus as their like base of operations. So Billy Wolf had a training gym, and so did another trainer who happened to be based in Columbus named Al Happ, another promoter. So these men, even though they were sexist in a lot of ways, they were ahead of their time in allowing black athletes and white athletes and black women and white women to train together. Even though, as Ethel talked about, some of the white women were more prejudiced than Billy Wolf himself. They would say, "Oh, I'm not going after that. I'm not going on the mat after that black girl because she has greasy hair or whatever." But I actually interviewed in the documentary one of the white wrestlers named Ethel Brown, who just happened to have the same son, Ethel Brown, who was white. She talked about how she and Ethel and Babs would kind of work out together and show each other moves. So they were formally trained. They were taught all the holds, all the ways you protect yourself and fall, and all the tumbling techniques. And so they were taught everything formally, but they also just had a natural knack for it. It's sort of like I would compare it to gymnastics. There are little kids who go into gymnastics class not thinking they're going to be in the Olympics, but they just kind of show a knack for it. And that's how the Wingo sisters were, Babs and Ethel. They just had a natural knack for wrestling holds and wrestling moves and being athletic.
Wow, that's so interesting, just about that time period, as you mentioned, about the promoter Billy Wolf and training the first women's wrestling champion, and then having the opportunity to open up this school due to the close proximity of different cities, with, as you said, with Columbus being within an hour's drive, and then, of course, with the challenges that these women face, let alone just training, forget about traveling to the different cities, just the challenges of training with their white counterparts and having to deal with things. But luckily, Ethel Brown was able to kind of be another mediator during that time period. And I want to stay just with the training sessions for a moment in this movie. In the documentary, did they describe how grueling were the training sessions, just in terms of how many hours they had to devote to the craft, and were there times that they wanted to quit?
Yeah, I don't know if they wanted to quit, because these women had so much grit and determination. And also, when you're young, Ethel talks about that. When you're young, you're not thinking about, oh, let me quit and do something. First of all, there weren't a lot of options for women or for black people. So this is not, it's not like, oh, I'm going to quit and go become a lawyer. So that just wasn't something that was commonplace for African Americans back then, being able to just go out and get any professional job. So I don't think they really wanted to quit, but Ethel talked about they were old school in the way that they trained. It wasn't all this. She even says it wasn't all these supplements and steroids and things that some athletes resort to in order to put on muscle mass. She said it was a minimum of 3 hours a day, several days a week, just weight training, and she called it bopping and knocking in the ring, getting beaten up. The way they developed their abs was they would throw medicine balls into their stomachs. She jokes in the documentary, she said, my abs were so developed that when I had my children, all the doctor had to do was stand there with a catcher's mitt. Because her abs were so developed. So she said, so this was really, really old school, hard, like you, Ramona Isbell says it was like if you were in basic training in the military. It was just hardcore, hours and hours a day, hitting the weights, just training in the wrestling ring, just for hours and hours a day. So it was very much old, you know. Kim Martin, Marva Scott's daughter, says she remembers the wrestlers eating sardines before their matches, to build up their lean protein. So they, even though there wasn't like really advanced exercise physiology the way that we have today, they knew certain things about how to, like certain things to eat to build up protein, lean protein, and how many hours a day you needed to exercise to build muscle mass. And if you look at some of the women in their photos, Ethel even says, she says, my body was like a rock. You look at her thighs look like boulders. I mean, they were just very, very, very into training and to knowing what they had to do in the ring so that they could avoid injuries. Because it's not like they had really good health care or whatever. So if you were injured, you would just, for however many weeks or months it took you to recover.
That is amazing. I mean, you gained an appreciation before what things were like pre-supplements and pre-workout, post-workout regimens. But man, you gained even more an appreciation because they were really dedicated to the craft. And I guess, as they say, you had to have ingenuity, as you mentioned about one of the wrestlers. In order to get protein, they would have to eat sardines. And I guess it worked because, I mean, they were dedicated to the craft. And, of course, they wanted to show off the work. And certainly it definitely paid off for them in a major way. And, I want to stay just with this documentary for a moment. Your documentary highlights black women professional wrestlers during the 50s, 60s, and the 70s. Something that's still relevant to this day is pay. Did they describe in the documentary about the pay and how tough it was to work the territories in terms of the pay? Can you kind of go more into detail about the territories that they worked in, what the pay scale was like for them?
Yeah, I could never really, no pun intended, pin down exactly how much they were paid. But sometimes it was like they would get a percentage of the door, and sometimes it was like a flat fee, like maybe $50 a week, but even $50 a week back in the 50s was decent pay. But Ramona Isbell says that they were definitely paid less than the men. And, we think of New York and California as ultra liberal states nowadays, but back then they were very conservative. And California at one point had banned women's wrestling because it was looked at as, vulgar and low class. And Ethel said that her dream was to wrestle at Madison Square Garden, but she said while she was wrestling, at least in the prime of her career, women wrestlers were banned from Madison Square Garden in liberal New York City, of all places, because, it was public standards of decency. But she said a lot of times, she said they would go all over the country. A lot of times they would go into the South, even though it was very segregated. A lot of their matches were in the South. And she said a lot of times they had to kind of, sometimes they were on the same cards with men. So you would see in the documentary shows some of these old posters where you would see mixed bills with men and women. Of course, the men were always the main attraction, but sometimes they would have women on before the men. And Ethel said, though, sometimes the men, they would have to wait for the men to, like, go through the circuit first in a certain territory, and then the women would go behind them if they weren't on the same card. So she said, she called it hurry up and wait. A lot of times you would have to wait for the men to, like, exhaust these territories, and, like, the fans would want a little bit of variety. So after the men had played certain cities several times, then Billy Wolf and other promoters would bring in the women. But their circuit was really international. Kim Martin tells a story about her mother, Marva Scott Pan, and having a bad experience where the mafia threatened her to, like, throw a match so she wouldn't be the winner, and dangled her out of, or threatened to dangle her out of, a skyscraper window, and she ended up having a nervous breakdown and having to be in a sanitarium in Japan for like a few months before she was able to, she was kind of even just mentally well enough to come back home to Columbus. And so their territories were the Midwest and the South, but also, as I mentioned, Latin America, Mexico. Ethel even talked about going to Puerto Rico and Cuba before the embargo, Australia and Japan, and different cities in Canada. Ramona Isbell tells a story about she was in Montreal, and a man, she was hanging out in a bar after one of her matches with Rowdy Roddy Piper, and Rowdy Roddy Piper was Canadian, so he knew how to speak French, and some man was hitting on Ramona. She was oblivious to it because she didn't speak French. And so Rowdy Piper later told Ramona that he threatened the man in French to leave her alone. So that was another interesting angle, that a lot of the men didn't see the women as, like, taken away from the sport. They were kind of like big brothers to them. They kind of were protective of them. They didn't see that, they didn't look down on them like, oh, you don't know what you're doing because you're a girl. They were actually very protective of them, which I thought was interesting.
Wow, that's amazing, just about that story you talked about with Roddy Piper. I knew Roddy Piper was Canadian, but I had no idea he spoke French. Thank you for letting me that and letting the listeners know as well. Wow, definitely some amazing stories in the documentary Lady Wrestler. And I want to talk now about just about black women in professional wrestling. So you covered in the documentary some of the greats that paved the way and blazed the trail for the current stars that we have as far as black female or African-American female professional wrestlers. We have Bianca Belair, Mercedes Moné, Jade Cargill, Bix Wohl. Also, we have La Rosa Negra. Also, we have Naomi. And also, we can go as far back as the Attitude Era with Jacqueline, just to name a few. Did you have an opportunity to talk to the wrestlers that were featured in the documentary? Did you have anything to, what did they think about the current talent of black female wrestlers that are out?
Well, you know, so Ethel and Ramona, those were the two living original, you know, black women wrestlers that I was able to interview for the documentary. They didn't say anything specific about any of the women who are famous now, the black women wrestlers who are famous now, but what they did say was that in their general opinion of professional wrestling in its contemporary form is they're not a fan of it. They say that it's just become more show than actual sport. Both Ramona and Ethel said back in their day, there was always the show, and even Ethel Brown, the white wrestler that I interviewed, even she said that yes, in their day, they had the show business element to it, but it was more athletic than it was show. And all three of them said they were not a fan of modern-day wrestling, that they just felt it was too much show and not enough sport in it. So Ramona said that she didn't even watch it. She said occasionally she would come across it when channel surfing, and she said she wouldn't even stay and watch an entire match if she came across it. She said she felt it was too much focus on the women, was too much focused on showing, you know, the women being sexualized and not celebrating them as real athletes. And Ethel said she felt like it was just, the women were just put on for titillation value and for, that's the same thing Ramona said, for to be sexualized, and that she said it just was totally, both, they all said it was just modern day wrestling is just, professional wrestling is just totally different from when they were in it. They saw themselves as real athletes, and they didn't name anyone in particular. They just said they see modern day wrestlers more as entertainers than as athletes. You know, and I'm sure a lot of modern day wrestling fans will not enjoy hearing that, but that was their opinion. And, you know, they're the elders. They're entitled to their opinion.
Absolutely. As they said, as the decades go by, the opinions are going to be definitely different. And as you said, they were definitely entitled to their opinion, how they felt, because they didn't have it easy. This was before pay-per-view and before cable television, so they went through the line of fire. And I want to stay just with black women in professional wrestling for a moment. Are you a fan of the current names that I mentioned, such as Bianca Belair, Mercedes Moné, Big Swole, Jade Cargill, just to name a few?
The only one that I've really had a chance to see and become a fan of is Big Swole. I actually met her at the first Black WrestleFest in New York last summer because they actually featured Lady Wrestler. They had a screening of Lady Wrestler during that event last summer, and she was just, Big Swole couldn't have been more accessible and just very complimentary of the women who came before her, like Ethel. I also got a Trisha Dora, you know, who's on the independent circle, as well as Amber Rodriguez. So I'm a fan of all those three women. I can't say that any of the other women that you named that I really follow their careers that closely, but I know that just like Ethel and Ramona and, you know, Kathleen Wembley and some of the other women back in the day, I know the women who are stars today, I know that they all work hard and they all take it seriously and they take the training seriously. So that's my opinion, is that I'm not contradicting the elders, but I just from the little interaction that I've had with wrestlers like Big Swole and Trisha Dora and Amber Rodriguez is that they take it very seriously as well.
Indeed, they do. Again, like as I stated earlier, there's a lot at stake here. There's more work for a lot of the wrestlers. There's more promotions and, of course, more money's involved in it as well. So the work is more open. As they say, times are different. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And speaking of the more things change, the more things stay the same, mental health. I know mental health has become more of a prevalent topic for, I would say, a decade and a half, almost two decades now, specifically in the black community. Was there any mentions? I know they dealt with so much. The wrestlers that you featured in the documentary, they dealt with so much from racism and just trying to be taken seriously as athletes. Were there any mentions in the documentary about mental health, about things feeling like, I know you mentioned that quitting was not an option, but did they have any moments where they struggled in terms of dealing with racism in the industry and segregation? Did it take a toll on them? Were there any lasting effects or any repercussions that came from in terms of mental health with the wrestlers that you featured in the documentary?
Yes, and the main episode or the main historical episode that deals with mental health is what you just mentioned, the episode with Marva Scott in Japan. And Marva Scott was Ethel Johnson's younger sister who got into the business after Babs and Ethel did. And as Kim Martin, Marva Scott's daughter, describes, it could have been the American Mafia who had this run-in with Marva where they threatened her. But that moment with Marva and those people from the Mafia threatening to dangle her from a skyscraper window if she didn't throw this match, that was sort of like a straw that broke the camel. Even though that was a very serious thing, it was sort of like, that was like the way Kim describes it, the accumulation of all the years of, as you said, having to deal with the segregation and the sexism. It was just like, that was like a point where Marva it was just too much weight to bear, and she had to be taken to a sanitarium to recover. So days, I don't even know if sanitarium still exists. Those are places where people with mental health issues would sometimes be forced to go against their will and sometimes voluntarily admit themselves. So that was an episode that really, really dealt with mental health as like the main challenge that Marva Scott as a wrestler dealt with at that time. But Ramona even said that she was very naive getting into the business and didn't really realize how much racism and all the segregation that they would have to deal with. And she, Ramona, even said, if I had known ahead of time, I don't know that I would have become a wrestler because it took such a toll. And Ethel says she doesn't use the word. She said it was very depressing. Now, I don't know if she was using it in the way we use the term depression today to mean clinical depression, where you go and take medication and you go and talk to a therapist to help you overcome depression. I think she was meaning it more in the sense of it got her down sometimes. Of, you know, here I am, an athlete, just wanting to do my job, basically. And then she said, Ethel said, sometimes they would have to forfeit matches because they would get threatened by the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan would say, if you let those black girls come inside the building, we're going to hang them. So Ethel said, yes, she got depressed sometimes. It just, you know, anybody dealing with that on a constant basis, it would get to them. So, yes, all the women that I spoke to said that they would have bouts of, I don't know, like I said, I don't know if they meant clinical depression or that it would just get to them sometimes. And that they didn't, like I said, I don't think they were actually considering quitting. But Ramona said, if I had known all this ahead of time, I don't know if I would have gotten into this business. So, yeah, they definitely had moments where it was like, is it all worth it?
Wow, that's just amazing right there. And, again, we salute them. You know, we salute the pioneers and the trailblazers that definitely paved the way for the current stars, the current black women that are in professional wrestling today. And definitely, it's definitely a documentary you need to check it out. The name of it is called Lady Wrestler. And, again, it's directed by Chris Bornay. And, Chris, again, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us on the program. Tell everybody where they can find you on social media, as well as Lady Wrestler. Any websites you want the listeners to know about, let them know that as well. And also, where can they watch Lady Wrestler?
Yes, people can watch Lady Wrestler on Amazon Prime Video. If you just enter Lady Wrestler into the search engine on Amazon, it should come up. And you can buy it or rent it. And there's also a Lady Wrestler Facebook page. If you just go onto Facebook and, again, just put Lady Wrestler into the search engine, the Facebook page should come up. And there's also a website, LadyWrestlerMovie.com, and then you can find me on social media under my name. My last name is Bournea, and I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram under my name as well. And thank you also for mentioning my YouTube channel. My YouTube channel is under my name as well. And thank you so much, Ed, for having me on the show and for bringing awareness to these women and to this chapter of history that I really feel like more people need to be aware of.
Absolutely. You're welcome anytime. And you heard it from him. He is Chris Bornay. He is a journalist, an author, and a documentary filmmaker with the documentary that he has titled Lady Wrestler, which chronicles black female professional wrestlers and their journey during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. Chris, again, thank you so much. And if ever you want to come back on, just feel free to let us know.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Ed. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I appreciate you as well. We'll be back with more right after this.
Babs and Ethel soon distinguished themselves from the pack. In 1953, Babs wrestled World Wrestling Champion Mildred Burke before a crowd of nearly 9,000 fans in Kansas City in what was billed as the first interracial championship.
The idea of putting a black woman in the wrestling ring, a sexy, good-looking athlete who moved well, and pitting her against a white woman or another black woman, he just thought that was a way to really attract the crowds and really attract the buzz, and it was, and it worked.
When executing often dangerous wrestling holds, Babs and Ethel showed amazing skill and ability.
Like, for instance, I could hook them with my foot, or I could hook them this way, or hook them that way, you know, or go behind, is what they say, go behind and face slam them, you know. These type of things that lots of girls didn't do. I worked in the... since they say mostly like the guys.
The lady wrestlers were in such peak physical condition that they could have given their male counterparts a run for their money.
Thanks for switching lanes to Raising Cane's.
One box combo, please.
That's four juicy chicken fingers. We'll start cooking. Garlicky butter Texas toast tastes as good as it's looking. Fresh coleslaw and crispy fries you won't be skipping. And our secret cane sauce you'll want to keep dipping. Plus, our lemonade or iced tea made fresh today by me. Yo, 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 here's your chicken to go.
Wow, that was fast.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love.
Modern life is noisy. Noise is everywhere. Excessive noise is harmful, linked to sleep deprivation, hearing loss, and heart disease. Should noise be the price we pay for progress? Actually, no. Many noise sources have quieter options. Gas-powered landscaping equipment is obsolete, with battery-powered options greatly reducing noise and air pollution. Audible car alarms are obsolete, with vehicle immobilizers and GPS tracking providing silent anti-theft technologies. Quieter backup warning sounds are available, and adjustable directional sounds are less intrusive. So what can you do to reduce noise levels? Talk to store and building managers about safe sound levels. Work with elected officials and the police to strengthen noise enforcement. Join Noise Free America, a coalition to promote quiet.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for another exciting edition of The Robinson Show. Once again, a big special thank you to Chris Bournet, journalist, author, and filmmaker from Columbus, Ohio. He is the director and producer of the documentary Lady Wrestler. The documentary focuses on the journey of African-American female professional wrestlers during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. Once again, a big special thank you to Chris for appearing on the program. And until next time, everybody, remember, put God first in everything you do, and you can't go wrong. Until next time, stick to the script. I'm out. Peace.